This is episode 135 of Social Entrepreneur with Gillian Caldwell of Global Witness.
There's room for people who are passionate enough to chart their own course.
Welcome to the Social Entrepreneur Podcast. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former business executive with Fortune 500 companies. Today, I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. Each week, we bring you exciting stories from the world of social entrepreneurs, benefit corporations, and impact investing. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to episode 135 of Social Entrepreneur with Gillian Caldwell of Global Witness. Have you ever wondered why so many countries that are rich in natural resources have some of the poorest populations? So think about it. Countries where you might find diamonds or rare minerals or palm oil or rubber plantations, these are often some of the poorest countries in the world. So why is that? Countries that are rich in natural resources are often the poorest. Well, it's because sometimes natural resources can be a source of conflict and corruption. And what Global Witness does is they investigate and they expose natural resource exploitation around the world. And so they break the link between natural resources, conflict, and corruption. Now, Gillian Caldwell is a great example of a social entrepreneur. She's been thinking about social justice since she was in high school, where she was the chapter coordinator for Amnesty International. About 18 months ago, she became the CEO of Global Witness. Before that, she has a rich history of social entrepreneurship. She was the CEO of One Sky, where she took on climate change. She was also the executive director of Witness. It's a platform for documenting violations of human rights. So here she is, Gillian Caldwell of Global Witness.
My name is Gillian Caldwell, and I'm the CEO of Global Witness. Global Witness is an organization that investigates, exposes, and advocates around natural resource exploitation around the world. And our aim is to reveal associated environmental and human rights abuses and corruption, and to drive systems change in order to deliver a more just and sustainable world.
Good stuff, by the way. I've been watching several of your videos, and I know you've only been with them for a couple of years, right?
Yeah, I started with Global Witness just over a year ago as their first externally recruited CEO in their 23-year history.
So let's stay with Global Witness for just one second. Can you give us a concrete example of some, you know, there was exploitation, Global Witness came in, what did you do, and then how did the system change as a result?
Sure. Well, we could start with the founding story of Global Witness, which is that over two decades ago, the three co-founders, Patrick Alley, Simon Taylor, and Charmian Gooch, were investigating the illegal timber trade along the Thai-Cambodia border, and they discovered through this undercover investigation that the timber trade was actually financing the bloody Khmer Rouge regime. And as a result of their investigation, they were able to secure international sanctions and diplomatic pressure, which essentially cut off the funding for the Khmer Rouge and helped lead to the downfall of the regime. So Global Witness was one of the first organizations to start to understand the relationship and the nexus between natural exploitation, natural resource exploitation, environmental and human rights abuse. They also pioneered the global conversation and understanding of conflict diamonds and helped set the stage for the Kimberley process, which is, of course, a very imperfect mechanism to addressing the problem of conflict diamonds, and yet a step in the right direction insofar as it's important to understand the origins of any precious gems and whether those gems were actually used to fuel and finance bloody civil wars. Basically, our work looks at Western enablers of corruption that help basically impoverish nation states by depriving them of the wealth that their natural resources should be able to generate. It looks at conflict states, conflict finance in fragile states, so the ways in which natural resources become a fuel for or the financing for ongoing conflict. And also we work on the forest lands and climate terrain where we're looking to end epidemic levels of land grabbing and industrial scale logging and to tackle the looming crisis of climate change. So more recently, to give you an example from our forest lands and climate work, we've been successful in securing a commitment from a Vietnamese rubber company that we had documented was involved in numerous land grabs, essentially confiscating with the collusion of the Cambodian government tens of thousands of hectares of land from impoverished farmers against the law, against international regulations. So we helped secure a commitment from that company to deliver, to return those confiscated lands to those landholders. Mm.
First of all, wow. just amazing work. Question for you, though. I was looking at your LinkedIn profile. It looks like, you know, like you were working with, you know, as a coordinator or volunteer with Amnesty International, like back in 1982.
Yeah.
So this isn't like your first day to be thinking about this. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what do you think was that thing within you that created the drive to take on social causes in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think, you know, in the social entrepreneur's terrain, there's a general thought, and I think, you know, for many years, Bill Drayton, who founded Ashoka and arguably the modern sort of movement of social entrepreneurs, took the position that you were sort of either born a social entrepreneur, a change maker, or not. And yet over time, even Ashoka's thinking has evolved to talk about an everyone a changemaker world. What can we do to empower and enable people to have the empathy and the skills and the drive to make a difference? So, I mean, I think in my case, it was a combination of nature and nurture. You know, neither of my brothers are doing social justice oriented work, and we had very similar early influences. But at the same time, I do think that my teachers were very influential for me. Most notably, I went to a high school where my history teachers, I think, saw in me a passion for social justice and introduced me, in fact, to Amnesty International back in ninth grade, so that I wound up getting involved in leading my school's chapter in Amnesty International. I also got involved in students and teachers organized to prevent nuclear war and organized a school-wide symposium. I became a vegetarian, stopped eating animals because I felt it was hypocritical if I wasn't capable of killing them myself, and so on. So, I mean, from an early age, I was thinking in very broad terms about the world around me and what difference I could make in it. And I think that was an instinct that was really encouraged by the school I went to and the teachers that befriended me.
And you worked in several capacities along the way. You were an attorney, you were an executive director. So kind of bring us through, you know, sort of your path that led you to Global Witness.
Well, you know, throughout my career, I've always had, well, first of all, never a sort of a straight line trajectory. I'm not somebody who had, you know, a clear designated point in mind. I do believe that, you know, the process is as important as the destination, and that what's most important in our professional lives is, you know, to find and to secure the privilege, really, to be able to do work that feeds your soul and that motivates you and energizes you, and that you really have to listen to your intuition to chart a path that makes sense to you, that it's a mistake to be too calculating in terms of how that path progresses. But I think, you know, I have had some thoughts along the way. I mean, one was that it was really important to get some combined experience with direct service and with systems changing advocacy work. So, you know, one of the things that frustrated me from an early age was seeing people with fancy degrees, but without any real lived experience delivering the services or trying to address the problems that they're advising on. So I did, you know, if you look at my early resume, get quite a bit of experience in different contexts, providing legal services, working in homeless shelters, and so on, to try to get some hands-on experience with poverty and the other forms of injustice that concern me. Another thing that I really tried to do without my career was balance an interest in the domestic work in the United States with an understanding that, you know, in an increasingly interconnected world, you know, there's no such thing as a truly or exclusively national concern. And especially being from the United States, that the United States has enormous influence globally, even in how it pursues its domestic agenda, as, for example, exemplified by its work in the criminal justice terrain and its sort of leading flag flying over many years in terms of being the largest incarcerator in the world and, helping expand the private prison industry and mandatory minimum sentencing, all quite negative trends that Obama's begun to begin to reverse in his final year in office. So trying to have that mix of domestic and international work, trying to have that mix of direct service and advocacy-oriented work are two consistent threads. And I'd say the other thread in my career has always been to try to understand the interconnection between problems. One of the reasons Global Witness has always been so exciting to me, and it's a reason that I really appreciate the work of Earth Rights International as well, is that it focuses on the intersection between environmental and human rights abuses. And all too often, we in the nonprofit sector and social enterprise terrain segment ourselves into human rights specialists. We're environmental specialists, but the truth is we just don't have the luxury to see those problems in separate compartments any longer. We have to divine a way forward where we actually have the right relationship between human beings and the natural world on which we depend.
I know that Global Witness works sort of at that intersection between natural resources, conflict, corruption, environmental degradation, and you talk about a thing called the resource curse. So what is the resource curse?
The resource curse is a term that I believe the co-founders coined. I may be wrong about that, but I was under the impression they did. And it really relates to this conundrum that some of the most resource-rich countries in the world are dealing with grinding poverty, environmental human rights abuse, and corruption. Let's think about West Africa, which is a very resource-rich terrain in terms of gold and tin, tungsten and tantalum, which are needed, for all of your electronics and your cell phones, precious and semi-precious gems, whether it's diamonds or other gems. Likewise, forests, timber, which is required for construction globally, and furniture. There's just so many natural resources, and yet many of the countries in West Africa and indeed around the world that are resource rich and should be blessed by those resources and have more than adequate budgets to cover health and education and to ensure a bright future for their populations are instead plagued by corruption, which is enabled by a whole Western infrastructure that Global Witness is working to expose, and environmental and human rights abuses.
So what do you do to follow the money? How do you do that?
Well, it varies on a case-by-case basis, but you're right that following the money is a core kind of component of our investigatory work. You know, obviously we have access to, LexisNexis and other databases that can give us information regarding company ownership and, related financial flows. The challenge actually that we discovered through our investigatory work, and one of the real challenges to following the money, which is so important to understand the abuses that we're trying to uncover, is that too often companies are shielded and the money itself is shielded by the existence of so-called anonymous companies. In 2014, Global Witness won the TED Prize for its wish to end anonymous companies. And anonymous companies are basically companies that prevent you access from understanding the true beneficial owners of the companies. And in fact, in almost all financially related crimes, you will see multiple anonymous companies involved, usually offshore tax havens, whether it's the British Virgin Islands or the Cayman Islands or elsewhere. The United States is, you know, a key incorporator of anonymous companies in Delaware and Nevada and other places. So following the money is critical, and part of the reason we're looking to end the existence of anonymous companies is that there's almost no valid purpose for shielding at least law enforcement and government officials, and preferably broader public scrutiny, from the ownership and the beneficial owners behind these companies.
Yeah. And so what are you doing to try to end these anonymous companies? Are you working in legislative activities?
Yes. So in the United States, by way of example, we recently, CBS 60 Minutes recently rebroadcast an expose that we did with them that basically revealed the problem of anonymous companies and helped lead to the introduction of bipartisan legislation in the U.S. Congress that would end anonymous companies in the U.S. That investigation was actually quite interesting. Our investigator wore a hidden camera and met with 13 attorneys in New York City, posing as an advisor to an African minister who wanted to launder hundreds of thousands of dollars in the United States without any fingerprints, without any visibility into his involvement, because he himself, this fictitious African minister, was really running on an anti-corruption platform. And of the 13 attorneys we met with in New York City wearing hidden cameras, 11 out of 13 provided operating instructions on how to launder that money, largely by using U.S. companies and or related offshore accounts. And those were all anonymous companies. And interestingly, one of the attorneys with whom we met was the then head of the American Bar Association, James Silkenot. So this was a very high-profile expose, and it led to the third reintroduction of a bill in U.S. Congress, which is still pending, which has not passed, and which really needs support. All that bill would do is require secretaries of state to gather one additional name when you're registering a company in their jurisdiction, which is the name of the actual beneficial owner behind the company. We've had much more, I should say, we've had much more headway globally on the problem of anonymous companies. The UK has been a real leader here, and just for the first time released extensive information and a government database on beneficial ownership, and numerous other countries in Europe are now following suit. So the U.S. is behind the times on the anonymous companies problem.
Yeah. What is Publish What You Pay?
Publish What You Pay is a campaign, a global and collaborative campaign that was really conceived by Global Witness. And the idea was that companies, particularly extractive industries like oil companies, should be required to publish what they pay governments on a project-by-project basis for access to those concessions. So in other words, if, say, Shell and Eni, and this is a real-life example, pay the Nigerian government for access to an oil block off the coast of Nigeria, in this case, OPL 245 is the name of the oil block, they should be required to make publicly available how much money they paid and to whom, to force accountability regarding where those funds actually wound up, i.e., did they wind up in the national treasury benefiting the citizens, or do they further drive the resource curse by getting fueled into offshore bank accounts? In the case of Shell and Eni and OPL 245, global witnesses proved that $1.1 billion went missing from Nigerian state treasuries with their knowledge and insight, and found its way into an offshore account. Now, that money would have been the equivalent of, I think, more than or almost half of the entire health and education budget for the country in the year in which it went missing. So we're still looking for accountability in that case. That Publish What You Pay campaign, incidentally, was successful in securing those requirements. So it is now a requirement that trillions of dollars in payments by extractive companies to governments are subject to publication on a case-by-case basis so that local citizens and NGOs can demand accountability.
You know, all of this work that you've been describing is expensive. Yeah. And so, you know, you're doing all these investigations and all that. So how is Global Witness funded?
So Global Witness has charitable status in both the U.S. and the U.K. We have offices actually in the U.S., the U.K., and soon to be in Brussels as well. And we're funded almost entirely by foundations and some intergovernmental funding bodies. We do have a small and growing portion of gifts coming from individuals, and that's a really important opportunity to grow the budget. At this point, our budget is $14 million annually, and we have over 110 people on staff around the world, and we're running 19 campaigns in 29 countries.
So, advice for early-stage social entrepreneurs. What's something that you've learned from your journey that you'd like to pass along?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, it's just so important to really to follow your passion and to tune into what really moves and motivates you, because this work requires all of you. And, you know, if you're not feeling really inspired by it, you're not going to sort of make it through the paces. At the same time, I do think a balance is really necessary. I mean, personal sustainability is so key in our sector. And it's so easy to become burned out, and especially with early stage social entrepreneurs in startup mode, it's very difficult to switch off. But in the long run, I think it's important to remember that, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint, and that you have to maintain your health and balance in order to see clearly and in order to keep doing that important work. And I think the final thing I would say, although there's so much advice I could offer, is that I really believe that the only change that's very meaningful in the world is change that happens in and through partnerships and collaboration and networks. And this isn't to dismiss the importance of a single individual and the difference they can make in the world, as Margaret Mead's quote is so famous for explaining, but rather to say that building and sustaining networks at a personal and organizational level is just so important to advancing really, really big changes in the world.
Yeah. So as people are looking for Global Witness online or on social media, where would they look?
So our website is at www.globalwitness.org, and you can find our Twitter and Facebook accounts there from the website, but we're obviously active on Twitter and Facebook and would welcome your engagement. We're actually soon to be launching, a brand new kind of state-of-the-art storytelling platform that helps us bring the stories of our campaigns to audiences in new and innovative ways and increases the opportunity for audience engagement and interaction. But I would encourage people to get active with us on social media and at the website and to learn more about how you can get involved.
Very good. I look forward to learning more about your storytelling platform.
Yeah.
So Gillian, call to action. People have been hanging out with you and me for like half an hour or so now. What's something you would love to see them go and do as a result of this conversation?
Well, I guess I'm thinking about today's world and the challenges that so many young people particularly face in finding their way into the marketplace and into employment that's gainful and meaningful to them. And, you know, I often wonder if those challenges are even more significant than they were at the time when I graduated. But I still have to believe that there's room for people who are passionate enough to chart their own course. And I would just encourage people to really be creative in thinking about how they find the opportunities that are passionate for them, whether it's through scholarships and funding that may be available at their universities, or through crowdfunding platforms, which is how I actually underwrote an important project I did for a year in Thailand just 2 years ago. I think, you know, generally speaking, and this is, I will admit, true in the event that you're not saddled by enormous student debt, which so many students are. Generally speaking, I think where there's a will, there's a way. And it may be that you need to find your way to that kind of lived experience that will make you a really competitive candidate for other kinds of roles, but that you can chart a course with a little ingenuity that will really give you the chance to do work that's meaningful for you in the world.
Very good. Well, Gillian, thank you so much for being with us on Social Entrepreneur.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us today. You are the reason that we produce Social Entrepreneur every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. If you'd like the show notes for today, head over to tonyloyd.com/135. That's TONYLOYD.com/135. Well, listen, thanks so much for joining us today. And until next time, please remember to use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. We'll talk to you next time on Social Life.